of them, and those who opposed him were too fixed in their thinking to be persuaded. They saw his point, but not as clearly as he did, and until they changed their way of thinking, he could do no more than what he was doing now, offering counsel, setting the stage. A man of surpassing patience, Yamata-san smiled politely and ground his teeth with the frustration of the moment. "You know, I think I'm starting to get the hang of this place," Ryan said as he took his place in the leather chair to the president's left.
"I said that once," Durling announced. "It cost me 3/10 of a point of unemployment, a fight with House Ways and Means, and 10 real points of approval rating."
Though his voice was grave, he smiled when he said it.
"So, what's so hot that you're interrupting my lunch?"
Jack didn't make him wait, though his news was important enough to merit a dramatic reply. "We have our agreement with the Russians and Ukrainians on the last of the birds."
"Starting when?" Durling asked, leaning forward over his desk and ignoring his salad.
"How does next Monday grab you?" Ryan asked with a grin.
"They went for what Scott said. There have been so many of these start procedures that they want just to kill the last ones quietly and announce that they're gone once and for all. Our inspectors are already over there, and theirs are over here, and they'll just go and do it."
"I like it," Durling replied. "Exactly 40 years, boss," Ryan said with some passion. "Practically my whole life since they deployed the SS-6 and we deployed Atlas, ugly damned things, with an ugly damned purpose, and helping to make them go away. Well, Mr. President, now I owe you one. It's going to be your mark, sir, but I can tell my grandchildren that I was around when it happened." That Adler's proposal to the Russians and Ukrainians had been Ryan's initiative might end up as a footnote, but probably not.
Grandchildren either won't care or they'll ask what the big deal was," Arnie Van Dam observed, deadpan.
"True," Ryan conceded. "Trust Arnie to put a neutral spin on things."
"Now tell me the bad news," Durling ordered.
$5 billion, Jack said, unsurprised by the hurt expression he got in return.
"It's worth it, sir, it really is. Tell me why."
"Mr. President, since I was in grammar school, our country has lived with the threat of nuclear weapons on ballistic launchers aimed at the United States. Inside of 6 weeks, the last of them could be gone."
"They're already aimed."
"Yes, sir. We have ours aimed at the Sargasso Sea, and so do they, an error that you can fix by opening an inspection port and changing a printed circuit card in the guidance system. To do that takes 10 minutes from the moment you open the access door into the missile silo and requires a screwdriver and a flashlight." "Actually, that was true only for the Soviet..." "Russian," Ryan corrected himself for the 1,000th time. "Missiles. The remaining American birds took longer to retarget due to their greater sophistication. Such were the vagaries of engineering science."
"All gone, sir. Gone forever," Ryan said.
"I'm the hard-nosed hawk here, remember? We can sell this to the Hill. It's worth the price and more."
"You make a good case, as always," Van Dam announced from his chair.
"Where will OMB find the money, Arnie?" President Durling asked. Now it was Ryan's turn to cringe.
"Defense? Where else?"
"Before we get too enthusiastic about that, we've gone too far already." "What will we save by eliminating our last missiles?" Van Dam asked.
"It'll cost us money," Jack replied. "We're already paying an arm and a leg to dismantle the missile subs, and the environmentalists..."
"Those wonderful people," Durling observed. "But it's a one-time expense." Eyes turned to the chief of staff. His political judgment was impeccable. The weathered face weighed the factors and turned to Ryan.
"It's worth the hassle. There will be a hassle on the Hill, boss," he told the president. "But a year from now, you'll be telling the American people how you put an end to the sword of Damocles," Ryan said.
"Catholic schools," Arnie chuckled. "The sword that's hung over America for a generation. The papers will like it, and you must know that CNN will make a big deal about it, one of their hour-long special report gigs with lots of good pictures and inaccurate commentary."
"Don't like that, Jack?" Durling asked, smiling broadly now.
"Mr. President, I'm not a politician, okay?
Isn't it sufficient to the moment that we're dismantling the last 200 ICBMs in the world?
Well, that wasn't exactly true, was it? Let's not wax too poetic, Jack. There are still the Chinese, Brits, and French.
But the latter two would fall into line, wouldn't they? And the Chinese could be made to see the light through trade negotiations. And besides, what enemies did they have left to worry about?
Only if people see and understand, Jack. Derling turned to Van Damme. Both of them ignored Jack's not-quite-spoken additional concerns.
Get the media office working on this. We do the formal announcement in Moscow, Jack?
Ryan nodded. That was the deal, sir. There would be more to it. Careful leaks, unconfirmed at first. Congressional briefings to generate more. Quiet calls to various TV networks and trusted reporters who would be in exactly the right places at exactly the right times.
Difficult because of the 10-hour difference between Moscow and the last American ICBM fields. To record for history the end of the nightmare. The actual elimination process was rather messy, which was why American tree-huggers had such a problem with it.
In the case of the Russian birds, the warheads were removed for dismantlement, the missiles drained of their liquid fuels and stripped of valuable and/or classified electronic components, and then 100 kilograms of high explosives were used to blast open the top of the silo, which in due course would be filled with dirt and leveled off.
The American procedure was different because all the U.S. missiles used solid fuels. In their case, the missile bodies were transported to Utah, where they were opened at both ends. Then the rocket motors were ignited and allowed to burn out like the world's largest highway flares, creating clouds of toxic exhaust that might snuff out the lives of some wild birds. In America, the silos would also be blasted open. A United States Circuit Court of Appeals had ruled that the national security implications of the International Arms Control Treaty superseded four environmental protection statutes, despite many legal briefs and protests to the contrary. The final blast would be highly dramatic, all the more so because its force would be about 1/10 millionth of what the silo had once represented. Some numbers and some concepts, Jack reflected, were simply too vast to be appreciated, even by people like himself.
The legend of Damocles had to do with a courtier in the circle of King Dionysius of Sicily, who had waxed eloquent on the good fortune of his king. To make a point in the cruel and heavy-handed way of great men, Dionysius had invited his courtier Damocles to a sumptuous banquet and sat him in a comfortable place, directly under a sword, which in turn was suspended from the ceiling by a thread. The purpose was to demonstrate that the king's own good fortune was as tenuous as the safety of his guest. It was the same with America. Everything it had was still under the nuclear sword, a fact made graphically clear to Ryan in Denver not too long before, and for that reason his personal mission since returning to government service had been to put the end to the tale once and for all.
"You want to handle the press briefings?"
"Yes, Mr. President," Jack replied, surprised and grateful for Derling's stunning generosity.
"Northern resource area?" the Chinese defense minister asked. He added dryly,
"Interesting way of putting it."
"So what do you think?" Zhang Hansan asked from his side of the table. He was fresh from another meeting with Yamata.
"In the abstract, it's strategically possible."
"I leave the economic estimates to others," the marshal replied, ever the cautious one, despite the quantity of Mao Tai he'd consumed this evening.
"The Russians have been employing three Japanese survey firms. Amazing, isn't it? Eastern Siberia has hardly ever been explored. Oh yes, the gold deposits at Kolyma, but the interior itself." A dismissive wave of the hand.
"Such fools. And now they must ask others to do the job for them."
The minister's voice trailed off and his gaze returned to Zhang Hansan.
"And so, what have they found?"
"Our Japanese friends. More oil, for starters. They think as big a find as Prudhoe Bay."
He slid a sheet of paper across the table.
"Here are the minerals they have located in the last 9 months."
"All this?"
The area is almost as large as all of Western Europe, and all the Soviets ever cared about was a strip around their damned railroads, the fools. Zhang snorted. All their economic problems, the solution for them lay right under their feet from the moment they assumed power from the Tsar. In essence, it's rather like South Africa. A treasure house, but including oil, which the South Africans lack. As you see, nearly all of the strategic minerals, and in such quantities, do the Russians know? Some of it, Zhang Hansan nodded. Such a secret is too vast to conceal entirely. But only about half, the items on the list marked with stars, are those Moscow knows about. But not these others. Zhang smiled. No. Even in a culture where men and women learn to control their feelings, the minister could not conceal his amazement at the paper in his hands. They didn't shake, but he used them to place the page flat on the polished table, smoothing it out as though it were a piece of fine silk. This could double the wealth of our country. That is conservative, observed the senior field officer of his country's intelligence service. Zhang, covered as a diplomat, actually conducted more diplomacy than most of his country's senior foreign service officers. It was more of an embarrassment to them than to him. You need to remember that this is the estimate the Japanese have given us, Comrade Minister. They fully expect access to half of what they discover, and since they will perforce spend most of the development money... A smile. Yes, while we take most of the strategic risks. Offensive little people, the minister added. Like those with whom Zhang had negotiated in Tokyo, the minister and the marshal who continued to keep his peace were veterans of the 8th Route Army. They, too, had memories of war, but not of war with America. He shrugged. Well, we need them, don't we? Their weapons are formidable, the marshal noted, but not their numbers. They know that, Zhang Hansan told his hosts. It is, as my main contact says, a convenient marriage of needs and requirements, but he hopes that it will develop, in his words, into a true and cordial relationship between peoples with the true who will be on top, the marshal asked, smiling coarsely. They will, of course, he thinks, Zhang Hansan added. In that case, since they are courting us, it is they who need to make the first overt moves, the minister said, defining his country's policy in a way that would not offend his own superior, a small man with elfin eyes and the sort of determination to make a lion pause. He looked over at the marshal, who nodded soberly. The man's capacity for alcohol, both of the others thought, was remarkable. As I expected, Zhang announced with a smile. Indeed, as they expect, since they anticipate the greatest profit. They are entitled to their illusions. I admire your confidence, the NASA engineer observed from the viewer's gallery over the shop floor. He also admired their funding. The government had fronted the money for this industrial conglomerate to acquire the Soviet design and build it. Private industry sure had a lot of muscle here, didn't it? We think we have the trans-stage problem figured out. A faulty valve, the Japanese designer explained. We used a Soviet design. What do you mean? I mean that we used their valve design for the trans-stage fuel tanks. It wasn't a good one. They tried to do everything there with extremely light weight, but the NASA representative blinked hard. You mean to tell me that their whole production run of the missile was... A knowing look cut the American off. Yes, at least a third of them would have failed. My people believe that the test missiles were specially engineered, but that the production models were, well, typically Russian. The American's bags were already packed, and a car was waiting to take him to Narita International for the interminable flight to Chicago. He looked at the production floor of the plant. It was probably what General Dynamics had looked like back in the 1960s at the height of the Cold War. The boosters were lined up like sausages, 15 of them in various stages of assembly, side by side, one after the other, while white-coated technicians performed their complicated tasks. These 10 look about done, They are, the factory manager assured him. When's your next test shot?
Next month.
We've got our first three payloads ready, the designer replied.
When you guys get into something, you don't fool around, do you?
It's simply more efficient to do it this way.
So they're going to go out of here fully assembled?
A nod. That's right. We'll pressurize the fuel tanks with inert gas, of course. But one of the nice things about using this design is that they're designed to be moved as intact units. That way you save final assembly time at the launch point.
Move them out by truck?
No, the Japanese engineer shook his head.
By rail.
What about the payloads?
They're being assembled elsewhere.
That's proprietary, I'm afraid.
The other production line did not have foreign visitors. In fact, it had few visitors at all, despite the fact that it was located in the suburbs of Tokyo. The sign outside the building proclaimed it to be a research and development center for a major corporation, and those who lived nearby guessed that it was for computer chips or something similar. The power lines that went into it were not remarkable, since the most power-hungry units were the heating and air conditioning units that sat in a small enclosure in the back. Traffic in and out was unremarkable as well. There was a modest parking lot with space for perhaps 80 automobiles, and the lot was almost always at least half full. There was a discreet security fence, pretty much like what would have been around any other light industry facility anywhere in the world, and a security shack at both entrances. Cars and trucks came and went, and that was pretty much that for the casual observer. Inside was something else. Although the two external security points were staffed by smiling men who politely gave directions to disoriented motorists, inside the building it was something else entirely. Each security desk featured hidden attachments which held German-made P-38 pistols, and the guards here didn't smile much. They didn't know what they were guarding, of course. Some things were just too unusual to be recognized. No one had ever produced a TV documentary on the fabrication of nuclear devices. The shop floor was 50 meters long by 15 wide, and there were two evenly spaced rows of machine tools, each of them enclosed with plexiglass. Each enclosure was individually climate-controlled by a separate ventilation system, as was the room as a whole. The technicians and scientists wore white coveralls and gloves, not unlike those required of workers in a computer chip plant, and, indeed, when some of them stepped outside for a smoke, passers-by took them for exactly that. In the clean room, roughly shaped plutonium hemispheres came in at one end, were machined into their final shapes at several stages, and emerged from the other end so polished they looked like glass. Each was then placed in a plastic holder and hand-carried out of the machine shop to the storage room, where each was set on an individual shelf made of steel covered with plastic. Metal contact could not be allowed, because plutonium, in addition to being radioactive and warm due to its alpha radiation decay, was a reactive metal, quick to spark on contact with another metal, and actually flammable. Like magnesium and titanium, the metal would burn with gusto, and once ignited was the very devil to extinguish. For all that, handling the hemispheres, there were 20 of them, became just one more routine for the engineers. That task had long since been completed. The harder part was the RV bodies. These were large, hollow, inverted cones, 120 centimeters in height and 50 across at the base, made of uranium-238, a darkly reddish and very hard metal. At just over 400 kilograms each, the bulky cones had to be precisely machined for absolute dynamic symmetry. Intended to fly after a fashion, both through vacuum and briefly through air, they had to be perfectly balanced, lest they become unstable in flight. Ensuring that had, to everyone's surprise, turned out to be the most difficult production task of all. The casting process had been reordered twice, and even now the RV bodies were periodically rotated, similar to the procedure for balancing an automobile tire, but with far more stringent tolerances. The exterior of each of the 10 was not as finely machined as the parts that went inside, though they were smooth to the ungloved touch. Inside was something else. Slight but symmetrical irregularities would allow the physics package, an American term, to fit in snugly, and if the moment came, which everyone hoped it would not, of course, the enormous flux of high-energy fast neutrons would attack the RV bodies, causing a fast fission reaction and doubling the energy released by the plutonium, tritium, and lithium deuteride within. That was the elegant part, the engineers thought, especially those unfamiliar with nuclear physics who had learned the process along the way. The U-238, so dense and hard and difficult to work, was a highly refractory metal. The Americans even used it to make armor for their tanks. It resisted external energy so well. Screeching through the atmosphere at 27,000 kilometers per hour, air friction would have destroyed most materials, but not this one. At least not in the few seconds it took, and at the end of the process, the material would form part of the bomb itself. Elegant, the engineers thought, using that most favored of words in their profession, and that made it worth the time and the trouble. When each body was complete, each was loaded onto a dolly and rolled off to the storage room. Only three remained to be worked on. This part of the project was 2 weeks behind schedule, much to everyone's chagrin. RV body number 8 began the first machining process. If the bomb was detonated, the uranium-238 from which it was made would also create most of the fallout. Well, that was physics. It was just another accident, perhaps occasioned by the early hour. Ryan arrived at the White House just after 7, about 20 minutes earlier than usual, because traffic on U.S. Route 50 happened to be uncommonly smooth all the way in. As a result, he hadn't had time to read through all his early briefing documents, which he bundled under his arm at the west entrance. National security advisor or not, Jack still had to pass through the metal detector, and it was there that he bumped into somebody's back. The somebody in question was handing his service pistol to a uniformed Secret Service agent. "You guys still don't trust the Bureau, eh?" a familiar voice asked the plainclothes supervisory agent. "Especially the Bureau," was the good-humored retort. "And I don't blame them a bit," Ryan added. "Check his ankle, too, Mike." Murray turned after passing through the magnetic portal. "I don't need the backup piece anymore." The deputy assistant director pointed to the papers under Jack's arm. "Is that any way to treat classified documents?" Murray's humor was automatic. It was just the man's nature to needle an old friend. Then Ryan saw that the Attorney General had just passed through as well and was looking back in some annoyance. Why was a cabinet member here so early? If it were a national security matter, Ryan would have known, and criminal affairs were rarely so important as to get the president into his office before the accustomed 8 o'clock. And why was Murray accompanying him? Helen D'Agostino was waiting beyond to provide personal escort through the upstairs corridors. Everything about the accidental confrontation lit off Ryan's curiosity. "The boss is waiting," Murray said guardedly, regarding the look in Jack's eyes. "Could you stop by on the way out? I've been meaning to call you about something." "Sure." And Murray walked off without even a friendly inquiry about Kathy and the kids. Ryan passed through the detector, turned left, and headed up the stairs to his corner office for his morning briefs. They went quickly, and Ryan was settling into his morning routine when his secretary admitted Murray to his office. There was no point in beating around the bush. "A little early for the AG to show up, Dan. Anything I need to know?" Murray shook his head. "Not yet, sorry." "Okay," Ryan replied, shifting gears smoothly. "Is it something I ought to know?" "Probably, but the boss wants it on close hold, and it doesn't have national security implications." "What did you want to see me about?" Ryan took a second or two before answering, his mind going at its accustomed speed in such a case. Then he set it aside. He knew that he could trust Murray's word, most of the time. "This is code word stuff," Jack began, then elaborated on what he'd learned from Mary Pat the day before. The FBI agent nodded and listened with a neutral expression. "It's not exactly new, Jack. Last few years we've been taking a quiet look at indication that young ladies have been enticed, hard to phrase this properly, modeling contracts, that sort of thing. Whoever does the recruiting is very careful. young women head over there to model, do commercials, that sort of thing. Goes on all the time. Some got their American careers started over there. None of the checks we've run have turned up anything, but there are indications that some girls have disappeared. One in particular, as a matter of fact, she fits your man's description, Kimberly something. I don't recall the last name. Her father is a captain in the Seattle Police Department, and his next-door neighbor is SAC of our Seattle office. We've gone through our contacts in the Japanese police agencies, quietly. No luck. What does your gut tell you? Ryan asked. Look, Jack, people disappear all the time. Lots of young girls just pack up and leave home to make their way in the world. Call it part feminism, part just wanting to become an independent human being. It happens all the time. This Kimberly-something is 20, wasn't doing well at school, and just disappeared. There's no evidence to suggest kidnapping. And at 20, you're a free citizen, okay? We have no right to launch a criminal investigation. All right, so her dad's a cop in his neighbor's bureau, and so we've sniffed around a little, but we haven't turned up anything at all. And that's as far as we can take it without something to indicate that a statute may have been violated. There are no such indicators. You mean a girl over 18 disappears, and you can't, without evidence of a crime? No, we can't. We don't have the manpower to track down every person who decides to make his or her own future without telling Mom and Dad about it. You didn't answer my initial question, Dan, Jack observed to his guest's discomfort. There are people over there who like their women with fair hair and round eyes. There's a disproportionate number of missing girls who are blonde. We had trouble figuring that out at first until an agent started asking their friends if they maybe had their hair color changed recently. Sure enough, the answer was yes, and then she started asking the question regularly. A yes happened in enough cases that it's just unusual. So, yes, I think something may be happening, but we don't have enough to move on, Marie concluded. After a moment, he added, if this case in question has national security implications, well, what? Jack asked. Let the agency check around? That was a first for Ryan, hearing from an FBI official that the CIA could investigate something. The Bureau guarded its turf as ferociously as a mama grizzly bear defended her cubs. Keep going, Dan, Ryan ordered. There's a lively sex industry over there. If you look at the porn they like to watch, it's largely American. The nude photos you see in their magazines are mainly of Caucasian females. The nearest country with a supply of such females happens to be us. Our suspicion is that some of these girls aren't just models, but again, we haven't been able to turn anything solid enough to pursue it. And the other problem, Murray didn't add, was twofold. If something really were going on, he wasn't sure how much cooperation he'd receive from local authorities, meaning that the girls might disappear forever. If it were not, the nature of the investigation would be leaked and the entire episode would appear in the press as another racist piece of Japan bashing. Anyway, it sounds to me like the agency has an op running over there. My best advice, expand it some. If you want, I can brief some people in on what we know. It isn't much, but we do have some photographs. How come you know so much? Sac Seattle is Chuck O'Keefe. I worked under him once. He had me talk to Bill Shaw about it, and Bill okayed a quiet look, but it didn't lead anywhere, and Chuck has enough to keep his division busy as it is. I'll talk to Mary Pat. And the other thing? Sorry, pal, but you have to talk to the boss about that. God damn it, Ryan thought as Murray walked out. Are there always secrets? Chapter 6. Looking In, Looking Out. In many ways, operating in Japan was highly difficult. There was the racial part of it, of course. Japan was not, strictly speaking, a homogeneous society. The Ainu people were the original inhabitants of the islands, but they mainly lived on Hokkaido, the northernmost of the home islands. Still called an aboriginal people, they were also quite isolated from mainstream Japanese society in an explicitly racist way. Similarly, Japan had an ethnic Korean minority whose antecedents had been imported at the turn of the century as cheap labor, much as America had brought in immigrants on both the Atlantic and Pacific coasts. But unlike America, Japan denied citizenship rights to its immigrants unless they adopted a fully Japanese identity, a fact made all the more odd in that the Japanese people were themselves a mere offshoot of the Korean, a fact proven by DNA research, but which was conveniently and somewhat indignantly denied by the better sections of Japanese society. All foreigners were gaijin, a word which, like most words in the local language, had many flavors. Usually translated benignly as meaning just foreigners, the word had other connotations, like barbarian, Chet Nomori thought, with all of the implicit invective that the word had carried when first coined by the Greeks. The irony was that as an American citizen, he was gaijin himself, despite 100% Japanese ethnicity, and while he had grown up quietly resenting the racist policies of the U.S. government that had once caused genuine harm to his family, it had required only a week in the land of his ancestors for him to yearn for a return to Southern California, where the living was smooth and easy. It was, for Chester Nomori, a strange experience living and working here. He'd been carefully screened and interviewed before being assigned to Operation Sandalwood. Having joined the agency soon after graduating UCLA, not quite remembering why he'd done so except for a vague desire for adventure mixed with a family tradition of government service, he'd found, somewhat to his surprise, that he enjoyed the life. It was remarkably like police work, and Nomori was a fan of police TV and novels. More than that, it was so damned interesting. He learned new things every day. It was like being in a living history classroom. Perhaps the most important lesson he'd learned, however, was that his great-grandfather had been a wise and insightful man. Nomori wasn't blind to America's faults, but he preferred life there to life in any of the countries he'd visited, and with that knowledge had come pride in what he was doing, even though he still wasn't quite sure what the hell he was really up to. Of course, neither did his agency, but Nomori had never quite understood that, even when they'd told him so at the farm. How could it be possible, after all? It must have been an inside-the-institution joke. At the same time, in a dualism he was too young and inexperienced to appreciate fully, Japan could be an easy place in which to operate. That was especially true on the commuter train. The degree of crowding here was enough to make his skin crawl. He had not been prepared for a country in which population density compelled close contact with all manner of strangers, and indeed he'd soon realized that the cultural mania with fastidious personal hygiene and mannerly behavior was simply a byproduct of it. People so often rubbed, bumped, or otherwise crushed into contact with others that the absence of politeness would have resulted in street killings to shame the most violent neighborhood in America. A combination of smiling embarrassment at the touches and icy personal isolation made it tolerable to the local citizens, though it was something that still gave Nomori trouble. "Give the guy some space," had been a catchphrase at UCLA. Clearly it wasn't here, because there simply wasn't the space to give. Then there was the way they treated women. Here on the crowded trains, the standing and sitting salarymen read comic books called manga, the local versions of novels, which were genuinely disturbing. Recently, a favorite of the 80s had been revived, called Rin Tin Tin. Not the friendly dog from 1950s American television, but a dog with a female mistress to whom he talked, and with whom he had sexual relations. It was not an idea that appealed to him, but there, sitting on his bench seat, was a middle-aged executive, eyes locked on the pages with rapt attention, while a Japanese woman stood right next to him and stared out the train's windows, maybe noticing, maybe not. The war between the sexes in this country certainly had rules different from the ones with which he'd been raised, Nomori thought. He set it aside. It was not part of his mission, after all, an idea he would soon find to be wrong. He never saw the cutout. As he stood there in the third car of the train, close to the rear door, hanging on to an overhead bar and reading a paper, he didn't even notice the insertion of the envelope into the pocket of his overcoat. It was always that way. At the usual place, the coat got just a touch heavier. He turned once to look and seen nothing. Damn, he joined the right outfit. 18 minutes later, the train entered the terminal, and the people emerged from it like a horizontal avalanche, exploding outward into the capacious station. The salaryman 10 feet away tucked his illustrated novel into his briefcase and walked off to his job, wearing his customarily impassive mien, doubtless concealing thoughts of his own. Nomuri headed his own way, buttoning his coat and wondering what his new instructions were.
"Does the president know?"
Ryan shook his head.
"Not yet."
"You think maybe he ought to?" Mary Pat Foley asked.
"At the proper time. I don't like putting officers at risk for..."
"At risk?" Jack asked. "I want him to develop information, not to make a contact, and not to expose himself. I gather from the case notes I've seen so far that all he has to do is make a follow-up question, and unless their locker rooms are different from ours, it shouldn't expose him at all."
"You know what I mean," the deputy director operations observed, rubbing her eyes.
It had been a long day, and she worried about her field officers. Every good DDO did, and she was a mother who'd once been picked up by the KGB's second chief directorate herself. Operation Sandalwood had started innocently enough, if an intelligence operation on foreign soil could ever be called innocent. The preceding operation had been a joint FBI-CIA show and had gone very badly indeed. An American citizen had been apprehended by the Japanese police with burglar tools in his possession, along with a diplomatic passport, which in this particular case had been more of a hindrance than a help. It had made the papers in a small way. Fortunately, the media hadn't quite grasped what the story was all about. People were buying information. People were selling information. It was often information with secret or higher classifications scrawled across the folders, and the net effect was to hurt American interests, such as they were.
"How good is he?" Jack asked. Mary Pat's face relaxed a little.
"Very. The kid's a natural. He's learning to fit in, developing a base of people he can hit for background information. We've set him up with his own office. He's even turning us a nice profit. His orders are to be very careful," Mrs. Foley pointed out yet again.
"I hear you, MP," Ryan said tiredly.
"But if this is for real..."
"I know, Jack. I didn't like what Murray sent over either."
"You believe it?"
Ryan asked, wondering about the reaction he'd get.
"Yes, I do, and so does Murray." She paused.
"If we develop information on this, then what?"
"Then I go to the president, and probably we extract anyone who wants to be extracted."
"I will not risk Nomuri that way," the DDO insisted, a little too loudly.
"Jesus, Mary Pat, I never expected that you would. Hey, I'm tired too, okay?"
"So you want me to send in another team, let him just bird-dog it for them?" she asked.
"It's your operation to run, okay?
I'll tell you what to do, but not how. Lighten up, MP."
The statement earned the National Security Advisor a crooked smile and a semi-apology.
"Sorry, Jack. I keep forgetting you're the new kid on this block."
"The chemicals have various industrial uses," the Russian colonel explained to the American colonel.
"Good for you. All we can do is burn ours, and the smoke will kill you."
The rocket exhaust from the liquid propellants wasn't exactly the breath of spring either, of course, but when you got down to it, they were industrial chemicals with a variety of other uses. As they watched, technicians snaked a hose from the standpipe next to the missile puskatel, the Russian word for silo, to a truck that would transport the last of the nitrogen tetroxide to a chemical plant. Below, another fitting on the missile body took another hose that pumped pressurized gas into the top of the oxidizer tank, the better to drive the corrosive chemical out. The top of the missile was blunt. The Americans could see where the warhead bus had been attached, but it had already been removed and was now on another truck, preceded by a pair of BTR-70 infantry fighting vehicles, and trailed by three more, on its way to a place where the warheads could be disarmed preparatory to complete disassembly. America was buying the plutonium. The tritium in the warheads would stay in Russia, probably to be sold eventually on the open market, to end up on watch and instrument faces. Tritium had a market value of about $50,000 per gram, and the sale of it would turn a tidy profit for the Russians.
Perhaps, the American thought, that was the reason that his Russian colleagues were moving so expeditiously. This was the first SS-19 silo to be deactivated for the 53rd Strategic Rocket Regiment. It was both like and unlike the American silos being deactivated under Russian inspection. The same mass of reinforced concrete for both, though this one was sited in woods and the American silos were all on open ground, reflecting different ideas about site security. The climate wasn't all that different. Windier in North Dakota because of the open spaces. The base temperature was marginally colder in Russia, which balanced out the wind chill factor on the prairie. In due course, the valve wheel on the pipe was turned, the hose removed, and the truck started up. "Mind if I look?" the U.S. Air Force colonel asked. "Please." The Russian colonel of Strategic Rocket Forces waved to the open hole. He even handed over a large flashlight. Then it was his turn to laugh. "You son of a bitch," Colonel Andrew Malcolm wanted to exclaim. There was a pool of icy water at the bottom of the Puskatl. The intelligence estimate had been wrong again. Who would have believed it? "Back up," Ding asked. "You might end up just doing sightseeing," Mrs. Foley told them, almost believing it. "Fill us in on the mission," John Clark asked, getting down to business. It was his own fault, after all, since he and Ding had turned into one of the agency's best field teams. He looked over at Chavez. The kid had come a long way in 5 years. He had his college degree and was close to his master's in international relations, no less. Ding's job would probably have put his instructors into cardiac arrest, since their idea of transnational intercourse didn't involve fucking other nations. A joke Domingo Chavez himself had coined on the dusty plains of Africa while reading a history book for one of his seminar groups. He still needed to learn about concealing his emotions. Chavez still retained some of the fiery nature of his background, though Clark wondered how much of it was for show around the farm and elsewhere. In every organization, the individual practitioners had to have a service reputation. John had his. People spoke about him in whispers, thinking, stupidly, that the nicknames and rumors would never get back to him. And Ding wanted one, too. Well, that was normal. "Photos?" Chavez asked calmly, then took them from Mrs. Foley's hand. There were six of them. Ding examined each, handing them over one by one to his senior. The junior officer kept his voice even, but allowed his face to show his distaste. "So if Nomuri turns up a face and a location, then what?" Ding asked. "You two make contact with her and ask if she would like a free plane ticket home," the DDO replied, without adding that there would be an extensive debriefing process. The CIA didn't give out free anythings, really. "Cover?" John asked. "We haven't decided yet. Before you head over, we need to work on your language skills." "Monterey?" Chavez smiled. It was about the most pleasant piece of country in America, especially this time of year. 2 weeks, total immersion. You fly out this evening. Your teacher will be a guy named Lialin, Oleg Yuryevich, KBG Major, who came over a while back. He actually ran a network over there called Thistle. He's the guy who turned the information that you and Ding used to bug the airliner." "Whoa," Chavez observed. "Without him..." Mrs. Foley nodded, pleased that Ding had made the complete connection that rapidly. "That's right. He's got a very nice house overlooking the water. It turns out he's one hell of a good language teacher. I guess because he had to learn it himself." It had turned into a fine bargain for CIA. After the debriefing process, he'd taken a productive job at the Armed Forces Language School, where his salary was paid by DOD. "Anyway, by the time you're able to order lunch and find the bathroom in the native tongue, we'll have your cover IDs figured out." Clark smiled and rose, taking the signal that it was time to leave. "Back to work, then." "Defending America," Ding observed with a smile, leaving the photos on Mrs. Foley's desk, and sure that actually having to defend his country was a thing of the past. Clark heard the remark and thought it a joke, too, until memories came back that erased the look from his face. It wasn't their fault. It was just a matter of objective conditions.
With four times the population of the United States and only one-third the living space, they had to do something. The people needed jobs, products, a chance to have what everyone else in the world wanted. They could see it on television sets that seemed to exist even in places where there were no jobs, and seeing it demanded a chance to have it. It was that simple. You couldn't say no to 900 million people. Certainly not if you were one of them. Vice Admiral V.K. Chandrasekhar sat on his leather chair on the flag bridge of the carrier Virat. His obligation, as expressed in his oath of office, was to carry out the orders of his government, but more than that, his duty was to his people. He had to look no further than his own flag bridge to see that. Staff officers and ratings, especially the latter, the best his country could produce. They were mainly signalmen and yeomen who'd left whatever life they'd had on the subcontinent to take on this new one, and tried hard to be good at it because, as meager as the pay was, it was preferable to the economic chances they took in a country whose unemployment rate hovered between 20% and 25%. Just for his country to be self-sufficient in food had taken how long? 25 years? And that had come only as charity of sorts, the result of Western agroscience, whose success still grated on many minds, as though his country, ancient and learned, couldn't make its own destiny. Even successful charity could be a burden on the national soul. And now what? His country's economy was bouncing back finally, but it was also hitting limits. India needed additional resources, but most of all, needed space, of which there was little to be had. To his country's north was the world's most forbidding mountain range. East was Bangladesh, which had even more problems than India did. West was Pakistan, also overcrowded, and an ancient religious enemy, war with whom could well have the unwanted effect of cutting off his country's oil supply to the Muslim states of the Persian Gulf. Such bad luck, the admiral thought, picking up his glasses and surveying his fleet, because he had nothing else to do at the moment. If they did nothing, the best his country might hope for was something little better than stagnation. If they turned outward, actively seeking room. But the New World Order said that his country could not. India was denied entry into the race to greatness by those very nations that had run the race and then shut it down lest others catch up. The proof was right here. His navy was one of the world's most powerful, built and manned and trained at ruinous expense, sailing on one of the world's seven oceans, the only one named for a country, and even here it was second best, subordinate to a fraction of the United States Navy. That grated even more. America was the one telling his country what it could and could not do. America, with a history of, what, scarcely 200 years? Upstarts. Had they fought Alexander of Macedon or the Great Khan? The European discovery voyages had been aimed at reaching his country, and that landmass discovered by accident was now denying greatness and power and justice to the admiral's ancient land. It was, all in all, a lot to hide behind a face of professional detachment while the rest of his flagstaff bustled about.
Radar contact, bearing 135, range 200 kilometers, a talker announced. Inbound course, speed 500 knots.
The admiral turned to his fleet operations officer and nodded. Captain Mehta lifted a phone and spoke. His fleet was off the normal commercial sea and air routes, and the timing told him what the inbound track would be. Four American fighters, F-18E Hornet attack fighters, off one of the American carriers to his southeast. Every day they came, morning and afternoon, and sometimes in the middle of the night to show that they could do that too. To let him know that the Americans knew his location and to remind him that he didn't, couldn't, know theirs. A moment later he heard the start-up noise from two of his Harriers. Good aircraft. Expensive aircraft, but not a match for the inbound Americans. He'd put four up today, two from Virat and two from Vikrant, to intercept the four, probably four, American Hornets, and the pilots would wave and nod in a show of good humor, but it would be a bilateral lie.
"We could light off our SAM systems, show them that we tire of this game," Captain Mehta suggested quietly. The admiral shook his head.
"No, they know little about our SAM systems, and we will volunteer them nothing."
The Indians' precise radar frequencies, pulse width, and repetition rates were not open information, and the American intelligence services had probably never troubled itself to find them out. That meant that the Americans might not be able to jam or spoof his systems. Probably they could, but they wouldn't be certain of it, and it was the lack of certainty that would worry them. It wasn't much of a card, but it was the best in Chandrasekhar's current hand. The Admiral sipped at his tea, making a show of his imperturbable nature. "No, we will take notice of their approach, meet them in a friendly manner, and let them go on their way." Mehta nodded and went off without a word to express his building rage. It was to be expected. He was the fleet operations officer, and his was the task of divining a plan to defeat the American fleet should that necessity present itself. That such a task was virtually impossible did not relieve Mehta of the duty to carry it out, and it was hardly surprising that the man was showing the strain of his position. Chandrasekhar set his cup down, watching the Harriers leap off the ski-jump deck and into the air. "How are the pilots bearing up?" the Admiral asked his air officer. "They grow frustrated, but performance thus far is excellent." The answer was delivered with pride, as well it might be. His pilots were superb. The Admiral ate with them often, drawing courage from the proud faces in the ready rooms. They were fine young men, the equal man for man of any fighter pilots in all the world. More to the point, they were eager to show it. But the entire Indian Navy had only 43 Harrier FRS-51 fighters. He had about 30 at sea on both Virat and Vikrant, and that did not equal the numbers or capability aboard a single American carrier. All because they had entered the race first, won it, and then declared the games closed, Chandrasekhar told himself, listening to the chatter of his airmen over an open voice channel. It simply wasn't fair. "So what are you telling me?" Jack asked. "It was a scam," Robbie answered. "Those birds were maintenance intensive. Guess what? The maintenance hasn't been done in the past couple of years. Andy Malcolm called in on his satellite brick this evening. There was water at the bottom of the hole he looked at today." "And?" "I keep forgetting you're a city boy," Robbie grinned sheepishly, or rather like the wolf under a fleece coat. "You make a hole in the ground, sooner or later it fills with water, okay? If you have something valuable in the hole, you better keep it pumped out. Water in the bottom of the silo means that they weren't always doing that. It means water vapor, humidity in the hole, and corrosion." The light bulb went off. "You telling me the birds probably wouldn't fly even if they wanted them to? Corrosion's like that, probably dead birds, because fixing them once they're broke is a very iffy proposition. Anyway," Jackson tossed the thin file folder at Ryan's desk, "that's the J-3 assessment." "What about J-2, Jack asked, referring to the Intelligence Directorate of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. "They never believed it, but I expect they will now if we open enough holes and see the same thing." "Me?" Admiral Jackson shrugged. "I figure if Ivan let us see it in number one, we'll find pretty much the same thing everywhere else. They just don't give a good fuck anymore." Intelligence information comes from many sources, and an operator like Jackson was often the best source of all. Unlike intelligence officers whose job it was to evaluate the capabilities of the other side, almost always in a theoretical sense, Jackson was a man whose interest in weapons was making them work, and he learned from hard experience that using them was far more demanding than looking at them. "Remember when we thought they were 10 feet tall?" "I never did. But a little bastard with a gun can still ruin your whole day," Robbie reminded his friend. "So how much money have they hustled out of us?" 5 big ones. "Good deal. Our federal tax money at work. We just paid the Ruskies $5,000,000,000 to deactivate missiles that couldn't leave the silos unless they set the nukes off first. Fabulous call, Dr. Ryan. They need the money, Rob." "So do I, man. Hey, boy, I'm scratching the bottom to get enough JP to keep our planes in the air." It was not often understood that every ship in the fleet and every battalion of tanks in the Army had to live on a budget. Though the commanding officers didn't keep a checkbook, per se, each drew on a fixed supply of consumable stores, fuel, weapons, spare parts, even food in the case of warships, that had to last a whole year. It was by no means unknown for a man of war to sit several weeks alongside a pier at the end of the fiscal year, because there was nothing left to make a run. Such an event meant that somewhere a job was not getting done, a crew was not being trained. The Pentagon was fairly unique as a federal agency in that it was expected to live on a fixed, often diminishing budget.
How much thinner do you expect us to be spread?
I tell him, Rob, okay? The chairman, just between you and me, the chairman thinks operations are something that surgeons do in hospitals. And if you quote me on that, no more golf lessons.
What's it worth to have the Russians out of the game? Jack asked, wondering if Robbie would calm down a little.
Not as much as we've lost in cuts. In case you haven't noticed, my Navy is still stretched from hell to breakfast, and we're doing business with 40% less ships. The ocean didn't get any smaller, okay? The Army's better off, I grant that. But the Air Force isn't, and the Marines are still sucking hind tit, and they're still our primary response team for the next time the boys and girls at Foggy Bottom fuck up.
Preaching to the choir, Rob.
More to it than just that, Jack. We're stretching the people, too. The fewer the ships, the longer they have to stay out. The longer they stay out, the worse the maintenance bills. It's like the bad old days in the late 70s. We're starting to lose people. Hard to make a man stay away from his wife and kids that long. In flying, we call it the coffin corner. When you lose experienced people, your training bills go up. You lose combat effectiveness no matter which way you go, Robbie went on, talking like an admiral now.
Look, Rob, I gave the same speech a while back on the other side of the building. I'm doing my best for you, Jack replied, talking like a senior government official. At that point, both old friends shared a look.
We're both old farts.
It's a long time since we were on the faculty of Canoe U, Ryan allowed. His voice went on almost in a whisper.
My teaching history and you prostrating yourself to God every night to heal your leg.
I should have done more of that. Arthritis in the knee, Robbie said. I have a flight physical in 9 months.
Guess what?
Down check?
The big one. Jackson nodded matter-of-factly.
Ryan knew what it really meant.
To a man who'd flown fighter planes off carriers for over 20 years, it was the hard realization that age had come. He couldn't play with the boys anymore.
You could explain away gray in the hair by citing adverse genes, but a down check would mean taking off the flight suit, hanging up the helmet, and admitting that he was no longer good enough to do the one thing he'd yearned for since the age of 10, and at which he'd excelled for nearly all of his adult life. The bitterest part would be the memories of the things he'd said as a Lieutenant J.G. about the older pilots of his youth, the hidden smirks, the knowing looks shared with his fellow youngsters, none of whom had ever expected it would come to them.
Rob, a lot of good guys never get the chance to screen for command of a squadron. They take the 20-year out at commander's rank and end up flying the night shift for Federal Express, and make good money at it, too.
Have you picked out the casket yet?
That broke the mood. Jackson looked up and grinned.
Shit, if I can't dance, I can still watch.
I'm telling you, pal, you want us to run all these pretty operations we planned in my cubicle. We need help from this side of the river. Mike Dubrow's doing a great job hanging paper with one hand, but he and his troops have limits, you dig?
Well, Admiral, I promise you this. When the time comes for you to get your battle group, there will be one for you to drive.
It wasn't much of a pledge, but both men knew it was the best he could offer. She was number 5. The remarkable part was, Hal Murray thought, in the office 6 blocks from the White House. It was all remarkable. It was the profile of the investigation that was the most disquieting. He and his team had interviewed several women who'd admitted some shamefacedly, some without overt emotional involvement, and some with pride and humor at having bedded Ed Kielty. But there were 5 for whom the act had not been entirely voluntary. With this woman, the latest, drugs had been an additional factor, and she felt the lonely personal shame, the sense that she alone had fallen into the trap.
So, Bill Shaw asked after what had been a long day for him, too.
So, it's a solid case. We now have 5 known victims, 4 of whom are living. 2 would stand up as rapes in any courtroom I've ever been in. That does not count Lisa Berenger. The other 2 demonstrate the use of drugs on federal property. Those 2 are virtually word of mouth. They identify the label on the brandy bottle.